Hey guys, Parsa here with a super quick announcement. If you love the Show ATL podcast, if you listen frequently, somewhat frequently, have heard it a few times and really like what you hear, whether it be the guests or the actual interview questions or the banter or the more kind of esoteric and edgy moments of the show, if you like me, that's cool. Great. Thanks. Whatever it is, if you really like the show, please consider making a small donation of your choosing to Show ATL at patreon.com. What your donation goes to is essentially helping our small team, which is me, Corrigan, and Coleman, continue putting the work in to make this show great week in and week out. Whether that be continuing to procure and source really awesome and meaningful and valuable guests for the show, or doing the research and work to create interesting, compelling, provocative, this interesting story narrative of the interview questions that we ask, or just the editing and production, post-production and marketing and everything else that goes into getting these shows out across all these platforms and into your listening ears every week, we would really, really appreciate your help, right? These things take a lot of time, resources, and energy, and we want to continue improving the show for you week in, week out. So if you go to www.patreon.com/showATL, that's patreon.com/showATL. You can make a recurring monthly donation of your choice. It can be as big or as small as you'd like it to be. Even a dollar a month goes a long way, believe it or not, if enough of you contribute. If you want to contribute more, we will be super grateful. But it will all go towards us putting in the work to make this a better and better program with time. At the very least, if you like us and don't feel like making a donation at this time, totally fine. Not at all required. We still love you. We'll still continue making this show for you as best as we can make it. But if you could go on whatever platform you use to listen to your show and give us a good rating or review, we would be equally grateful and appreciative because we do this all for you, our listeners. We love you. We thank you. And I'll get on to the episode now. Thanks. Bye. My guest today is Greg Noblin. Greg is an Atlanta-based artist who uses photography to create these mystical, surrealist, fantastical scenes that depict things that are both familiar and alien and otherworldly all at the same time. Greg uses toys, animals, various household elements, things that are organic, inorganic, and various just aesthetically intense and wild designs, whether photographed in the real world or created digitally, to put these pieces together in a way that is almost a mix between Dali and Magritte, which we talk about in the episode. Now that, in and of itself, is really overly simplifying Greg's work, because it is truly stunning the way Greg creates these things that resonate with us in ways that are deeply familiar, but at the same time create an element of magic and fantasy that we can't quite put our finger on. He uses photographs to outline a basic idea and then makes them look not at all like photographs. And if you see Greg's work, you really kind of understand where I'm going with this. We talk about Greg's journey through being a worker at a plant to knowing deep down that he wanted to do something creative with his life and with his mission and with his purpose, moving from Ohio to Atlanta, meeting his now wife and moving into the world of art, becoming professionally educated and starting immediately on his commercial journey of selling and creating art as he is now a full-time artist. We do talk about that commercial professional aspect of it a lot and what it means to be a full-time artist and what the actual processes, both from a art and technique perspective as well as a business perspective, look like to a professional full-time artist while still kind of maintaining that creativity, using that creativity to make a life for oneself. So a bit of a long intro, but well-deserved intro to Greg Noblin. Please enjoy today's episode with the man himself, Mr. Greg Noblin.
Any given moment, we know what the world is feeling.
Are
Are you wearing pajama pants to school? Why, yes, I am.
I was, in a way, elevating him. I was celebrating him.
We wanted to build a beer pong table.
No, it's the Show ATL podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of the Show ATL podcast, the podcast where we seek to find and highlight Atlanta creatives and creators. Today, our guest is the fantastic Atlanta artist, Greg Noblin, known for his surrealist photography artwork and a blend of all kinds of crazy formats, mediums, imagery that we're going to get into. Greg, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming. Just learned recently that you made quite a drive to come down here. So I do appreciate it. Not going to call out where you live for privacy's sake, but thank you for making the drive and being here. Gorgeous day. Got our coffees in front of us, ready to rock and roll. And we just spent a good amount of time talking about keto diet and food.
Yes, of course.
So
the number one topic.
So, and you were telling me that you actually do get asked quite a bit about the diet and about your journey through whatever, you know, with food and exercise and things like that. So, I mean,
sure.
If you care to just like kind of touch on that super quickly about how you got into the keto diet and how it's helped you generally just, you know, both as a person, but mainly as an artist and through your work and how that kind of defines your pace in your life.
It's kind of been this lifelong journey. My 20s were consumed with drugs and alcohol. And ever since that, it's been this process of elimination, I think. And, you know, I was completely out of control in every aspect of my life, diet, nutrition, especially. And I needed to lose weight. So about 5 years ago, I went ketogenic. Since then, you know, that only worked for so much. And I wasn't doing any exercises. It doesn't matter which diet you do. The one that works for you and that you can stay on is the one that you should be doing. Right. And I'm not a fan of the word diet. You've probably heard people say that a lot. It's more of a lifestyle because the diet that you can stick to for a long period of time becomes your lifestyle. And I was doing that and I wasn't doing any kind of physical activity. And for what I do in the art world is I'm at a computer all day or sitting taking pictures of elements or sitting taking pictures of elements outside. So I have like a studio setting, like a photo studio setting that I can shoot like toys and things with. And then I have the times that I go out and shoot landscapes or whatever. But if I'm shooting landscapes for source material or animals at zoos and wherever for source material, I'm sitting in my car, I'm sitting on a bench. I'm not, you know, and even then I might walk 2 or 3 miles at the zoo, but that's, you know, once or twice a year. I hit up a buddy of mine from high school through social media, and he became a bodybuilder years ago, and he wrote up a nutrition plan based around my ketogenic requirements and wrote out a fitness program for me to do to lift weights because I told him I am not going to do cardio. I know enough about myself. I know my limitations. I know what I will and won't do right. in many respects. And I'm not going to run ever. You know, if the doctor says you need to start training for a 5K, or you're dying this weekend. I'm dying this weekend. Let's make some party plans because I'm not going to do it. So yeah, keto kind of like it changed my relationship to food. You had mentioned that I don't track now and I don't really track. I kind of know what I need to do and I can gauge by how my body feels. Mm-hmm. But initially I did track, you know, every gram of the macronutrients. So yeah, so then I just started following his program at the gym and started seeing results and have been going from there. But yeah, keto has really been a life changer for me. Yeah. And it's really hugely popular now. It's like the big trend and people are resistant to get it against it and say it's unhealthy. And some people say it's super healthy or whatever. It's not sustainable long-term. I've done it for 5 years. I'm doing okay.
Yeah, you look great.
Thank you.
Well, hell yeah. I wanted to just kind of round off that topic since we were already talking about it. I thought it was just kind of a good intro to you and to the episode. And you mentioned a lot of elements of your work in that description, you talked about photography, going to the zoo for source elements, you talked about sitting on hours on end for editing work on your computer, things like that. All things that I think are excellent segues to what I want to get into. Before we fully transition, though, what's the one piece of keto-related advice you would give somebody if they're listening to this and they're just like, okay, I want to get started. What is the very first thing they should do?
Find out how to avoid the keto flu, but it's a two-part thing. And find out how to, like, there's a lot of people that fail because they don't have the energy. Mm-hmm. It's like, I went keto and I lost all my energy. I got the keto flu and I felt like crap for a week and I just couldn't do it anymore. And that's because they're eating too little fat. That's why they have no energy. They're in this transition phase and the keto flu is just generally, it's low electrolytes. So I get like 5,000 milligrams of sodium a day.
Oh, wow. Yeah, okay.
It's a lot.
Yeah. But I mean, it's all part of a balance.
Right. If I don't, I cramp.
Yeah. Interesting. So. Okay. Well, cool. There we go. So anyone who's listening to this and they thought, you know what? I want to listen to a podcast about art. And I also want to go on a keto diet or keto lifestyle, I should say. There you go. Your first piece of advice from the episode. But Greg, getting into your artwork, I think I first saw a piece of your work through Kai Lin, mm-hmm. who I feel like I'm, you know, always kind of dropping his name on this show because he has been a tremendous friend and resource to so many people in Atlanta in the arts community. I think it was the main promo piece or banner piece for the Infinity show at Kai Lin. And if that's the wrong show, then forgive me. I don't know. But your work has been up at Kai Lin Gallery in various capacities for a while, different shows. Mm-hmm. And what it immediately captured my eye, and I imagine the eye of so many others, because it is very surreal. The imagery that you produce, use of different flora and fauna kind of mixed with these playful elements, often kind of childlike elements. My favorite one is You Are Not Alone, which is a picture of a rhino with a balloon coming off its horn right on landscape. Mm-hmm. Just an example of the different elements that you blend together to create your work. I didn't know that your work used actual photography as its main element, right? And I think that's the point, right? And that you take photographs and, in your own words, you make them not look like photographs. Mm-hmm. So let's get into you and how, before we kind of get into the actual artwork, I want to talk about the man behind the artwork and how you got to creating these truly fantastical, really beautiful, oftentimes very big, surrealist paintings and artworks through photography. So you describe yourself, at least the way you described yourself to me on the questionnaire I sent out, was being an introvert and a hermit.
Yeah.
And just doing a little bit of background on you, learn that oftentimes what you put out into your work is things that you have just kind of imagined in your head from different parts of your own life, whether that's your youth or something nostalgic, and then you want to kind of capture that on the page. So how did you get into art in the first place?
I always wanted to do something creative. It's funny, the introvert hermit thing, I think that comes... I just made a connection. It's that stems from my general dislike of reality, and that ties into you know, my experience, especially through my 20s. So I always wanted to do something creative. I was involved in music in high school. I marched in drum and bugle corps. I was always drawn towards the creative expression kind of side of things. Mm-hmm. And that's what I wanted to do in college. And I lived in small town Ohio, Sandusky, Ohio, right on Lake Erie, Cedar Point, if you know it. And there was a General Motors factory there. My father worked there, and then they needed to hire people. And so I'm living in small town, like Rust Belt, USA, 25,000 people in this town. They hired, a few hundred people, and there was this lottery system, and you had to go through all this testing and like dexterity tests. Can you do certain tasks in a certain amount of time correctly and through repetition? But the thing is, like, those tests had nothing to do with like the actual jobs that were in there. The jobs were like all pretty much automated. We were just kind of like managers of the automated machines and just had to do some maintenance type work every few hours on those machines, and just to make sure that they were on size and stuff, because they're machines and they could go bad in a way. I got in and I was like, you know, 20 years old, living in small town Ohio. The total overhead of everything, car payment, rent, and everything is like $600 a month, utilities, all of that, right? And I'm making like 90 grand and it's absurd. And I started becoming resentful because I wanted to do something creative. And you know, I listened to my parents say, you need to get the job that has stability, that offers the benefits that you can retire from, that's going to give you the pension. And as we know now, that kind of thing doesn't exist really anymore, yeah, right?
There's no guarantee of being that company man that used to exist.
That's right. Selfishly, I as I grew into that position and just kind of working for the paycheck and slaving away, my resentments, they were selfish resentments at my parents for, you know, getting in the way, quote unquote, getting in the way of me doing what I wanted to do. And because of that hatred and self-hatred and resentments and really nothing to do in this town, I kind of just sought escapism through drugs and alcohol. And that just kind of allowed it to bury. After like 4 years of that, 5 years of that, an opportunity came to, this was 2004, an opportunity, we could transfer, and I was putting in for transfers other places. So I eventually transferred to the Doraville plant here, and I had gotten clean, and it's where I met my wife, Jennifer, and I didn't meet her at the factory. But that's about the same time I got clean, met her. I wanted to keep doing this. I wanted to start doing this creative thing. I wasn't exactly sure what it was, but I wanted to do this. And I had coworkers saying, you have to get out of here. I've been here. I'm 54. I have 4 years till I'm retired. My body's broken. You have way more to live for than this. And these were like coworkers.
Right.
Lifelong GM people with, you know, 28 years of seniority or whatever. And I knew that I just needed to go do something. And it was at that point that I realized that, like, my resentments at my parents and all that stuff, they weren't keeping, I was the one allowing someone else to keep me from doing what I wanted to do. So I was to blame. So, okay, I have this opportunity. And it came along, General Motors offered buyouts, a lump sum of cash to quit.
Wow.
So that's what I did.
Hell yeah.
I took it, quit. I was with Jennifer and...
And what year is this?
This would have been the end of 2005.
Okay. And you came to Atlanta in 04, you said?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So moved to Atlanta, still not really doing art.
Not at all. Not at all.
No art at all.
Working 6 days a week on an assembly line, yeah.
And in a new place, having met your now wife, everything kind of ripe to shake you out of that rigid foundation of thinking that this is the only option, right? And then so in 2005, you take... the lump sum, you quit, and then I imagine art kind of takes over from there, or
yeah,
is there another step?
Okay. I just went to the Art Institute of Atlanta, just went. What my plan was to use that money from the lump sum, pay off all my debt, get some student loans to get through school, and then have that cash to just live on for 4 years. So I was very fortunate to not really have to struggle, and it was just how it kind of played out. So I had that money. I mean, it ran out long before the photography school is expensive when you're processing and, you know, buying film and need a camera and all of that stuff. It goes quick. But still, you know, I was in a very beneficial position.
So you studied photography and that was it, basically, in terms of kind of what you focused on educationally. Mm-hmm. And did you start with more traditional photography and your artwork?
Mm-mm.
Okay.
So my epiphany, if you want to call it that, where my style derived from was in school. I said, you know, I'm going to go to school for commercial portraiture. And that's what I wanted to do. You know, let's just go into offices, corporate settings and shoot headshots and do environmental portraits for CEOs or entrepreneurs or restaurateurs and in their setting and that sort of stuff, right?
Right.
I thought that was really fun and interesting. And then I had my first class with Photoshop and game changer. At that point, I realized I could make any world that I wanted to. There was no limits. The only limit was the craziness that I could pull out of my head. So Yeah, we had to emulate one kind of artist. Her name's Maggie Taylor, and people can look her up, and they will see a distinct parallel between her work and my work. And there's several others that have come along that are similar, but we all have like our own little twist on it. Maggie Taylor uses pastels generally to make her backgrounds, and then she scans those in, and her subject matter comes from like taking photographs of elements that she will use, but like the main subject is almost always a person, and it comes from like an old tintype, daguerreotype, or something that she's found at a flea market, and she scans that in and colorizes it in Photoshop. So yeah, she was a huge inspiration. The other, you know, Dali, the surrealist.
Of course. Right? Yeah, which you can see a lot of that in your work.
Magritte. So we kind of had to like emulate those because that class was geared more towards surrealist creative type work, specifically because of the instructor that was giving the class, as it was to, because it was a commercial photography school. So, but the Photoshop class, the first one wasn't geared towards how to cut hair out and make it look great for a commercial type. It wasn't really a commercial application. It was more of a art kind of application in that Photoshop class. And I was terrible at Photoshop.
I mean, you got to start somewhere, right?
That's right. And what ended up happening is most people were spending lots and lots of time in the studio shooting. I mean, and I did too, to fulfill the requirements, but I was going into the digital darkroom and just being bad at Photoshop for hours and hours and hours, just trying different things. And this was 2006, 2007 time frame. So YouTube had just started. YouTube started in 2006.
So not a lot of online resources for you to go and look up and say, how the hell do I do this?
That's right.
It's trial by fire.
There was no lynda.com. I think lynda.com came along right at the end of 2010. Okay. But yeah, I mean, now if I'm like, oh, how do I make sparkly something? I can find a tutorial.
For sure. Yeah. YouTube video for everything out there now.
Yeah, absolutely. But then it was sparse, and it was books with CDs with source material that you had to, you know, go through the projects that they had in these books, these how-tos. And so, yeah, I would just spend hours and hours and hours. And eventually I got to a point where my instructors realized that I wasn't going to go the commercial route at all. And I was granted a fair amount of leniency in what I was allowed to do versus what some of the other students were allowed to do. A lot of students would try to say, oh, I'll fix it in post. I'll fix it in Photoshop. No, you get it right on, you know, on set, on how it's set up on the table. You make sure that the lighting's right there and don't fix it in Photoshop. And towards the end, the very end, like my last maybe two quarters of school, they knew that I was going to put in the work digitally. So I wasn't trying to cut corners. Those other students might have been trying to cut corners, or they have demonstrated that they're fixing it on the set results are going to be better than the results that they would have gotten if they would have. They've demonstrated that their Photoshop wasn't as good as their.
Interesting. So there's two components to it. You can't just be good at the program, or you can't just be good at the photography to make a really compelling piece, you know, kind of like the work that you make. Or you mentioned Margaret Rogers, what was her name?
Maggie Taylor.
Maggie Taylor. Man, I butchered
Renee
that
Renee Magritte.
One.
So I think we're...
Well, Renee Magritte, I'm very familiar with his work. Sure. This is not a pipe. The man and the apple.
Absolutely. And the umbrellas.
The umbrellas, yeah. I was just about to say, your work is very Dali and Magritte-esque. Mm-hmm. If you were to combine the two, the world of the surreal... Mm-hmm. That you put your characters in, but the characters and the placements of the objects themselves are very Magritte-esque.
Sure.
And the way that you kind of juxtapose them.
Right.
Alongside this kind of broader world that you paint.
I think that's where the art, the commercial side comes in, like of the classes that I took. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of kind of design elements in the balance of placing and using, you know, your traditional design methods of rule of thirds and high ground, low ground, you know, those sorts of things. And so those play a part for sure.
Certainly. You describe your progression as this kind of constant linear path of failing forward, right? You say you want to embrace failure
for sure,
while working towards a goal. I think that's especially in art, especially something where you're putting so much of yourself into something and you have to be vulnerable to embrace that mindset, I think is liberating in a lot of ways and ultimately makes anyone a better artist or a better producer of their work. The idea of learning through failure and embracing failure and knowing in the end that there's no shame to failure, right? It's failure is a part of the growth process, no matter what you do. So what has been an example of a failure that you can really point to as being pivotal in your journey as an artist or a period in your life where you were failing often to get to something that you really like in your work now?
It's really interesting that you use the word pivot, because I think pivot is a very important thing. However, for my failures, I can't think of a specific, there are specifics, but it's just like this timeline of failure. When someone says that they have changed, if they've really changed, they can tell you where that pivot was. That's like important, okay. Right? So I think, I was being bad at Photoshop, being terrible at making panels, like the physical construction. I'm not a carpenter. I'm really bad at it. I was using butt joints and not angles, and like the shit was wobbly and it was falling apart. And it's like, oh, what am I doing? And I can think of, you know what, I can think of several pieces that I made, had to sand down to the, sand through all the photograph paper, all the glue back down to the bare wood, redo it, sand it back down, redo it. And the third time, and then it sold for a discount. You know what I mean? It's like, it's really funny because that's just part of the process. Part of the process is getting good at the process. The process, fall in love with the process. There's so many things about failure that I just hear other people say that is an important aspect of where they've gone and where they're going to. Failure is, like you said, nothing to be ashamed of. It's something that if you succeed, I don't think you really necessarily learn anything. It's when you fail that you can have some retrospection on what has just happened. And it can be in a big, big moment of your life or something as trivial as, oh, I can't do this with this material. And eventually you learn what you can and can't do. And through that, what has really helped me is when a mistake does happen, because of all of those, that accumulation of failure, when something does happen, I know how to fix it based on my experience with my process and my method.
There's a story about Picasso that I think I've said it on this podcast at least 3 or 4 times over the, you know, year plus we've been doing this by now, but it's Picasso later in his career as an artist sitting in a cafe in Paris doodling on a napkin, and somebody looks over and says, wow, that's really gorgeous drawing. You know, can I buy that off you? And he said, sure, it'll be $10,000 or, you know, francs or whatever, the equivalent at the time. And she said, that took you like 10 minutes to draw. And he said, no, this has taken me a lifetime.
That's right.
To get to being able to do this. And it's incremental improvement over time, constantly.
That's right.
With the process. And that's brilliant.
That's perfect, because that's what you're really supporting when you purchase a piece of art, right, from any of these artists, is this process. What's really interesting is I was thinking a year ago or so about that process and about the failing and how that failure develops your work method, your step-by-step guide. And when you get to a point where all of that's kind of automatic, that workflow is automatic, you don't have to know which button to push on the piece of equipment to get it to do this one thing or whatever, that's automatic. Once that your whole process has become more automatic, I think that's when the better ideas come, at least for me. In my opinion, like, right, my better ideas, my better work has just now started because of a lot of that fighting with the process to learn how to do it properly has become automatic.
And so now you have more space, you feel, to actually think through the creative portion and the ideating and things like that.
I'm not stressing out over whether I need to use nails or screws. What kind of wood fill do I need to do if I do use screws? And
yeah, you've
figured that out.
Yeah, you've put that off to muscle memory, and now that's right, opened your mind up to actually being able to, you know, do the default things that need to actually, you know, happen to get the work done, but you are able to pour more of that energy into the creative piece. Do you have a lot of your kind of early artwork when you first started doing this? And do you ever look back at it for either inspiration or reference or anything like that? And just in general, it doesn't have to be the most early pieces, but how much do you use your previous artwork as reference or inspiration or anything going forward with new art?
I don't think that I do.
Okay.
I look at stuff for sure, like the older stuff, but not in a like a retrospective influencer of new ideas.
Right.
It's really weird. I don't know the names of all of them sometimes. And this is something I think every creative, every artist or anyone that's really passionate about what they're doing, whatever that thing is, they can look back on iterations of it or versions or completed products or pieces or whatever it is. And they can like close their mind and remember specific details about what that is. And I can do that. I can think back to a piece or whatever. And I don't have to necessarily look at the digital file in this case to kind of have that retrospection. And if I'm doing a piece that's going too far towards something that I've done in the past, maybe that's okay. It just really depends. Yeah, so I have this mental catalog of like past pieces. So like, right. You Are Never Alone is one that you referenced earlier. I'm not going to do the same thing with a horse instead of a rhino. That's exactly the same, right? I'm not going to put a parakeet on the horse's nose with a balloon. I'll change it up somehow. And recently did a piece that's just a horse with a butterfly on its nose. It's similar, but it's not the same. So there's various alterations, but there I have a mental catalog. What I tend to forget are the failures, like the failed pieces.
Yeah. Which might be a good thing. I mean, it seems like
I keep them. I have a folder full of like, what was I thinking?
Really?
What was this disaster about to happen?
Yeah.
Yeah, I keep those because I think those are more beneficial than kind of remembering the successful ones. I mean, you do want to remember the successful ones because, yes, we're creators, we're artists, we want to change the world or whatever, but at the end of the day, it's a business,
right?
And you need to make things that sell. And that's not necessarily saying, hey, I need to, you know, focus my work on sellable products or to change necessarily your agenda at how you're making the work or what you're trying to say with the work. But you know, you want to kind of be more towards successful ones and more successful kind of material versus, you know, ones that aren't as successful.
Sure. I mean, you can reference, you know, failures and successes alike. I think that to your point, the honing of that process, you start to just have a more intuitive understanding of what might be successful over time, right? Or maybe not.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that comes to that design, the commercial education that I got.
Of course, yeah.
You know, I know, like, if I were to put words on my stuff, I would know to not use 30 different fonts because that's not effective.
Sure.
You know, keep it to 2-3 max.
You mean in one piece or across pieces?
Like in one piece, like if that's what you were going to do. If you make a poster, you want, or you have a magazine cover, you want to keep the number of fonts
to
a minimum,
yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Unless your point is to be over the top and put 30 fonts on it, you know? So if you're going to skew one way, skew it, do it. Don't kind of, do they really want to use 4? Should it have been 2?
Don't send the mail. Don't be lukewarm. Yeah.
So
yeah, really do it if you're gonna go one way or the other.
That's right. It's not so much about commercialism. I just think that design thing is kind of ingrained, and I think I tend to like things that are more generally accepted as pretty, beautiful, or whatever. I mean, horses, owls. Yeah. I love those kind of. I love animals in general. Elephants. Yeah. I think animals are fascinating. They're this alien life form that's right. They're so weird. And they're so humanistic. And
it is weird to think about how, what would it be like if you saw a certain animal for the first time ever? You know,
I know.
What would your reaction be to, let's say, the first person who ever saw a camel or Albrecht Dürer, the lithograph artist, presented this is now a famous lithograph of the rhinoceros. which I believe now either in the original or a copy sits in the Biltmore House in Asheville, North Carolina. But it's a depiction of a rhino purely on hearsay, and he had never seen a rhino. And it's this weird kind of morphed armor-clad looking alien thing, you know, which isn't too far off from what a real rhino looks like. But you look at this as this primitive, this very talented and skilled artist for his time, putting together his best idea of what this weird alien animal looks like.
Was he informed? Like, did someone...
Yes, he was.
Give him a description?
Yes.
So he drew from descriptions?
Yeah, let me see if I've got my laptop here. I'm going to pull it up because it's blind, fascinating.
Kind of blind yet informed interpretation of... look at that.
That's his interpretation of the rhinoceros. Dürer's rhinoceros, and this is... In terms of depictions of flora and fauna, generally speaking, more fauna than flora, because that's kind of... has a chronology and a history all its own, but... this is a pretty pivotal piece in how people started depicting animals and how, biologically speaking, close that had to be to the real thing. It's obviously different when you're using photography, right? Because you're getting the actual essence and full complete picture of the animal.
That's right.
Was it always animals? I mean, did you kind of start with that? Okay.
Yeah, largely toy animals. And now I'm trying to move more towards real animals. And a business side, toys kind of limit your ability to license the imagery for reproduction houses and things like that, because the toy is a copyrighted, identifiable.
Gotcha. Right? Gotcha.
And even if
you couldn't tell like who made the toy from the picture,
if they couldn't tell, I mean, it only takes once for them to raise a stink, you know. Yeah. And if it's in a fine art sense and you're selling it on, like, you know, they're doing canvas prints on Target or whatever. Right. Of it, that's, you know, one thing. I don't think they necessarily would have a big issue with. It's when any other kind of commercial application, like, oh, let's slap it on a Coke can. I'm not going to be able to do that. I don't know that I necessarily would ever do that, but a toy prohibits that. And you lose a little bit of, that's not like the main or only reason, the first reason, I guess, but by seeing and being and spending time with real animals, like be it in a zoo or stopping on the side of the road and like kind of trying to get the horses to do something that's in someone else's pasture or whatever, standing in a ditch. Right. There's this moment of a real kind of connection with what that animal is specifically, and taking those photographs and kind of remembering the environment of what I'm closing my eyes, because when I do that, I can like remember certain aspects of certain photographs that I've taken, like the temperature, what I could smell, where my car was parked on the side of the road, and just kind of like, was there kind of any interaction with that animal? Using photographs of real animals versus the toys, it brings a level of authenticity to what I'm trying to do. Because I'm really trying to use the animals as a metaphor for our common human experience. So the animals are us, and if it's a toy, it doesn't come across sometimes. And I think that's like maybe one of the failures that I see in like pieces that some people might really like, but I feel the pieces that have the real animal in it have the more attachment, either from me or from the viewer. And that's not always the case, because there's some animals I just can't get a photograph. I can't get a photograph of a whale underwater.
That's fair. But I have seen works with fish and with whales and things like that. Right. Those are toys.
Going to be toys. It's just too... I'm not going to be able to get that.
Well, really. Yeah, of course. I mean, unless you were to, you know, procure some incredibly expensive and sophisticated underwater equipment and hope to get a usable shot, right? Which hell, it may happen. But look, I want to kind of time travel a little bit now and go back into the chronology, the story. So you mentioned around 2007, this is really when you started pivoting into the style of work that you are doing now, using inspiration to build these surreal worlds in Photoshop and through photography. When did you start really trying to commercialize that work and moving into moving from amateur to professional artist. What did that transition look like for you? Because you're now represented by Kylan Art, globally represented by U Gallery, and then...
That's an interesting... That's something that I would like to talk about later.
Yeah, of course.
As a tip to everyone.
And then Brick Gallery in Ohio.
Right. They actually... not anymore. Their building got blown over through a tornado. So,
Well, that's sad. yikes. Well,
it's okay. It's okay. Everybody's safe. It's all okay.
We're gonna forget I said that. but you are now very well represented as a professional artist.
Mm-hmm.
So what did that transition look like for you? And we had already kind of touched on the process of improving the craft, but what about the process of improving kind of the professional side, right? The salesman, the artist as profession. How did that come about for you?
Okay, so it happened immediately. When I went through school, it was a little different. It was a much different experience. I had gone to school for 2 years mm-hmm. before General Motors, just for music. Okay. And then the General Motors thing happened and I was just like, see you later, right? So I basically, but I wasn't doing anything in a major really. I just had, you know, some English and math and science classes knocked out, you know, your
right.
general requirement classes. I started school, I was like 30. So I'm in school with a bunch of 18-year-olds, right? Complaining about workload, complaining about this, complaining about, I'm like, I've done the 12, 16-hour a day, 6 day a week, you know, go home, eat, sleep, shower, do the same thing the next day.
Right.
You know, I have to go to this doctor's appointment. How do I get this into my schedule? How do I do that? You know, like, so.
Things change when you've been through it.
Yeah, I've had that. It doesn't make me a better person. I just had that life experience. So I wasn't overwhelmed by course load or that sort of stuff. It's like, okay, I just got to do this. So I'm just going to do this. And then I'm going to do this. And then I'm going to do this. And then we'll just get through it. And then
next week.
I graduated. I was like 34 in like 2010. And what I did is I mentioned that my teachers allowed me to do some things a little differently than some of the other students because of living in the digital lab.
Right.
Like I wasn't the one that's like, oh man, I really want to hurry up and get home. And I was like, don't close the lab yet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things when we graduated, there was a requirement was they made us have to like two big giant prints. My portfolio instructor, I said, what if I did, because I was allowed to invent one of my own classes. And in that class, I got to, instead of doing an internship, I had to write up the curriculum and have it approved and all of that stuff. And so the idea of the class was to work with textures and materials and just learn textures and materials. So I started using encaustic wax. I learned how to make encaustic wax and then put it on photos and just do like photo encaustic and put that on panel and that sort of thing. I had made like five pieces that were 24 by 24 square of pieces that I had done as part of the Photoshop classes. So basically it was a 10-week course and mess with materials or whatever, and then pick one and then make five pieces using my method or whatever that I wanted to do and present those as like the final project of this 10-week class. I built some panels and they were 24 by 24. My decision was to use photographs that my digital illustrations mm-hmm. is what they were called then, but yeah, the digital illustrations, and then apply an encaustic wax medium to them.
Okay, on wood.
Right, so I'd have the images printed. So I had them printed at PPR. I mounted those. So I had to learn how to mount using a dry mount, a repositionable mount. Not really, it is a dry mount. It's like a tape, sort of. And it comes on a big roll. And so I mounted those to the panel, applied the wax, made the presentation. And that really began the, I want to do more than just prints and I want them to be kind of like this. So I had these five at the end of the class, at that class, and they just kind of sat at home.
Mm-hmm.
And because I had like a year, 18 months or something left of school.
Right.
And then my last year of school, I suggested to my portfolio instructor, I said, hey, I have these five. Why don't I use those five encaustic pieces that I did for that one class as part of my, and he said, you know, you've created a few more pieces since then. If you do 15, it's a deal. So I said, okay. So I got to work. I made 10 more panels and had 10 more prints made up and then, you know, mounted them and did the encaustic thing with them. And instead of having like my little table in front of my two, like for a graduation thing, two prints and a table where I stand in front of it and talk about the work or whatever, I had 15 pieces in like half, you know, half of the space that we had. And then right after graduated, I emailed like every gallery in Atlanta. I said, this is who I am. Here's pictures of the stuff. Two replied. Yukai replied. And this is when he was on like it was Roswell and Peachtree, like right where it splits, right. Now this is on 10th Street.
Well, he's on 10th now.
It was on 10th and Peachtree. Peachtree and 10th is where he was. And then he moved from there to the Roxy, near the Roxy. And then from there to where he is now. So Yukai reached out, and this was like his second year that he was a gallery. Right. Yeah. And PBJ Gallery. They both called me. PBJ Gallery was very interested, but my price point was too high. They were at the time, I don't know what they are now, but at the time they're basically like 500 and below. Yukai said, how many pieces do you have? I said, I have 15. He says, bring a couple of your favorites down to the gallery and let me see them. He had a situation where someone like dropped out. He couldn't fulfill the requirement for the show or something. Like he had an immediate need for someone to put stuff on the wall for a show. And he liked what he saw and he said, great, bring them all on Saturday. Or whatever, like for the show. He's like, you're in the next show. And it was just fortuitous. It's that saying that luck is where opportunity meets preparation.
Right. And that was it.
He presented an opportunity, and I happened to have 15 pieces that were done, ready to go. They were in the show, and a couple of them sold. And because it's a business, and when things sell, there's the relationship, right? So it was luck. It was right place, right time, right people. And through him, man, he has really given me, he's an amazing person. He's really given me the space to grow and develop and to learn those things that I didn't learn in school, like how to make panels, like really make panels, how to kind of like be bad at some things. And me being open to being told that, hey, this is bad. You need to like rethink this a little bit. And kind of fight a little back and forth about some things and then kind of realize that, yeah, maybe I need to change a couple of things or whatever, but just kind of grow. He gave me space and time to grow.
And that's what you need in any relationship, not only creative, right? Sure. If you want to grow as a professional, whatever you're doing, you that's need right. that honesty.
That's right.
You know, because you could spin your wheels with somebody giving you praise all day, but then when the truth comes, it's going to be a far bigger blow to you.
That's right.
And to your ego than if somebody has just been honest with you. From the get-go.
That's right.
You know? So, yeah, no, he's a great guy, far more knowledgeable than he lets on because he's a little, you know, he's quieter and he's incredibly just warm and sociable.
Mm-hmm.
But that guy knows what the hell he's doing.
He absolutely does. Yes, he does.
and shout out to him for making this introduction.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So, but now what is your production rate? I don't want to get into like too technical, whatever, but
it's not much. There's been so many variations on like what to do on. So this is what I do full time, right? And I don't have a day job.
Day jobs are overrated, man.
Well, you know what? I did it. And I said, I'm going to jump off this thing without a net. And if I end up living under a bridge, then I'm under a bridge. But I'm going to go for it. And so there's been this process of figuring out like kind of how to manage production, but keep some like things at certain price points. So people, there's more availability because not everybody can afford $3,000, $6,000, $12,000, whatever $1,000. But someone can afford $400, $800. And a lot of that came from like friends, just old friends from years past saying, I really like this and I'd like, you know, to get something. Do you have anything? And you know, yeah, it's $8,000, you know, plus $800 for shipping. Sure. Yeah, I can't do that, right? So, but they can do $400. That's where like prints and big panels come into, you know. My production rate is I do between 12 and 20 a year.
12 and 20 that
individual
that
pictures
are, that are going to sell, or 12 and 20 that
total.
Okay.
I have no idea how many are going to sell.
Well, I mean, how many do you scrap is my point. Like, how many do you look at any and you're like, no, I don't like this in the bin.
Yeah, but at that point, that's at a digital file level. So I haven't put the time or effort.
Gotcha. So you've never actually gone through and put the panels together, put it up on a wall, and you're like, I don't know. I don't like it. You're an artist, so
it's
ingrained in you to be hypercritical of your work at all times, right?
But sure. Spotting the flaws that no one will ever see. There are a couple that I have that I'm like, that should never have been made for sure. I can think of specific ones. But you know, someone once told me, once you make it and you put it on a wall, it's not yours anymore. It's not for you to decide whether it's good or not. You put it on the wall, it's up to the world to decide.
Yeah. We've had variations of that kind of same sentiment expressed on the show from different artists, and that if you let yourself get too caught up emotionally in the work, then you're not meant to be a professional artist and sell your work. Once you put it out there, you have to be okay with whoever does or does not like it, whoever ends up buying it. They have to see the value and the art in it. It's for other eyes to now decide and judge outside of just your own.
That's right. And also just kind of understand that not everybody's going to like it.
You would hope not, right? I mean, you would think that you're doing something that's either different enough or good enough or crazy enough that you do get people on both sides of the fence saying, hey, that's either the best thing I've ever seen in my life, or I'm not that into that, or that sucks, right?
You have to be able to deal with it. Yeah. Photography. Hell are you doing?
No, but
right. I mean, you hear it all, and that's fine. Yeah. That's why there are a bunch of different artists doing a bunch of different things and a bunch of different galleries showing a bunch of different artists. Right. There's variety, and that's fine, and that's good, and that's healthy. And, you know, if someone loves it, that's wonderful. If someone hates it, that's wonderful.
Right. Yeah.
And
you need both.
Yeah. I can't target market. I'm going to make this for the specific type of people. Now what I tend to make is going to tend to be liked by people that tend to like what I make.
Sure. And over time you kind of hone that down further and further, and you build the following, and you build you almost educate the customer in a way, right? You're saying this is my style and my work. Yeah, go ahead. You just had a light bulb.
That's
go off.
What people like Yukai do. And that's why they're so important and so beneficial to what the artists that he represents in gallery, when they represent the artists that they do, is there are intermediary. Making the work, what it means, all of that is a third of what it is. There's a third that is networking, relationship building, kind of like that sort of thing. And a third of it is business. It's taxes and gallery relationships and trade shows and fairs or whatever, selling Velvet Elvises out of the back of your van at a gasoline parking lot, right? Whatever, right. Whatever it is, that's a third of it. Like the selling of it, the marketing, the drumming up the business, the doing the thing. There's all kinds of avenues to get those, and multiple income streams is hugely important. And you know, there's this like misconception that gallery artists have it made, and you know, that's all we have to do, and it's really not.
Well, as you see something on the wall for $10,000, and you're like, oh, you know, these guys are killing it. You know, great, great source of, you know, livelihood, whatever. But then you look back at what all goes into everything behind the scenes of not only just like meeting your own financial needs personally, but meeting the production needs of being an artist and the supply side of what it actually costs to be able to be a full-time artist.
Right. And that's when you have to manage, you know, material costs, and you need to know what's sustainable and what's not sustainable, and how to use quality materials that are going to hold up over time, or if you are specifically using materials for a specific reason that aren't supposed to hold up for, you know, whatever your message is or your thing is. There might be a reason for you to not be using super duper, you know, Series 9. So yeah, but that goes to that third of it that's a business. You know, you have to manage. Like if you make something that's $1,000 and it's going into a gallery and there's going to be the commission, you know, 50% commission. So if it sells at cost or at price, it's going to be $1,000. You're going to get $500. If it cost you $300 to make it and you're selling one $1,000 thing like that at that cost rate, you're making $200 a month.
Yeah.
And it retails at $1,000. So, you know, you have to like figure out, do your prices need to go up? Do your material costs need to go down? And that's that whole figuring out your process part.
Yeah. Business is a hugely important side to this. It's, I mean, don't really want to give away too much on air, but is something that we're moving towards as a company.
Sure.
Is how do you take creativity and understand the business side of that and make it work for everybody, right? There is a marketplace that is asymmetrical on information and on exposure and really understanding how the mechanics behind it all work. And how do you make that work for artists and for consumers, right? There's a lot of times I've traveled to different countries and met different artists enough to know that there is still a vast global mentality of being anti-business, anti-commercial in being an artist and making art. What would you say to someone who, you know, they come across with the attitude of like, no, man, like I just make art for me. And like, yeah, like, you know, I wanted to sell, but like, you know, fuck business, man. Fuck like being commercial, man. Like, you know, channeling a little bit of like the dude, right? In that anecdotal example. But what do you say to somebody who wants to be a full-time artist, but can't come to terms with that idea
selling out,
becoming commercialized, having to be good at business, liking making money, right? That's a big hurdle for artists is actually wanting to make money off of artwork, right? Just that mental block. How do you respond to that person who's out there who wants to be a full-time artist but doesn't want to sell or sell out?
I would say if you have a message, if you have something that you're strongly passionate about, a cause, whatever it is, and you don't want to do, you don't want to sell out to the man or whatever, why not get so good at their game and use their tactics to get your message out and get paid for it? It's all about like creativity, and creativity doesn't have to necessarily be on the page. It could be a tactic. It can be a business strategy. Artists think way differently than your typical business person, and there's a lot of outside the box DIY, you know, bootstrapping kind of ethos to like their work ethic, and they could utilize those skills that they have almost innately. Like it's a sense, and use that to outsmart the world that they so hate, and yeah, you know, and use that to their advantage. And I think that I don't necessarily see anything bad in selling out at all. There's nothing wrong with making money to make ends meet and, you know, creating some financial stability for yourself and your loved ones and those around you. It provides you an opportunity to make yourself a better person, so you can be a better person for someone else, and then they'll be a better person, hopefully, to somebody else based on their experiences with you. And it's like that butterfly effect.
Right.
And if someone is a fuck the system, I'm not going to get involved, I'm not going to sell out, then guess what? Your message was, you're never going to change that system. You're never going to get in there and get your foot in the door to get your message into that. And that system's always going to exist because you completely avoided it. If you want to change it, get involved with it.
Yeah, that's brilliantly said. I agree. I think that ultimately, and I've always kind of, the more I have grown and interacted with, I used to be in the business corporate world for several years. I've, you know, studied economics and finance at school, went into consulting, did the whole game, right?
Sure.
The whole rat race, and understand, like you, but through a different industry, what it means to really just grind it out for however long and put in the work, right? And then leave at the end of the day still being like, well, why am I doing this? And is there more out there for me? And then ultimately taking the plunge to do that. But I do think that in the end, we're all figuring out how we play the game, right? I don't think just because you have this kind of fuck the world, fuck the system mentality, doesn't mean that it's going to change just because you want it to change or you think it's going to change.
No, and the person that'll be fucked at the end of the day is going to be that person.
Right. We're all living within the same parameters. We're all playing by the same rules of the game. It's just how do you play the game, right? And I think that thinking about the commercial aspect of whatever you're doing is, that's how the world works, man. That's the engine of the world, is that whether it be art or whether it be insurance, you have to understand the engine of the world and then use that to, as you say, infiltrate and outsmart all of those things that you seek to topple and destroy, right? Which is, I mean, there's so many of my personal heroes fall into that same parameter, right? They were able to infiltrate the system, put themselves in that position of selling out, and then doing so in a way where their message really, really was able to be proliferated and put out into the world. But not going to harp on that too long, because I feel like we could really get into some philosophical debate. But wanted to read something from your own website, and then I want to get into kind of your own mental process of how the world in your head becomes the world that is manifest through your work, right? And this is just, I'm not going to read the whole thing. There's the About Me section on your website, which is gregnoblinart.com. Just a few kind of blurbs from this that fascinated me. Daydreams and impossibilities are commonplace in my mind. When a scene or story jumps into my consciousness, I feel compelled to act and collect source material. Once all the images are photographed and digitally cut up, and the vision I had in my head begins to emerge on the screen, I become elated. When I see with my eyes what I saw in my mind, there is a connection I make to my childhood memories of imagination. Even then, the image needs a soul. And then you mention past imaginations, texture, nostalgia, warmth, intrigue, tying the organic to the rigid. And there's a lot. There's like four or five paragraphs. I'm not going to read all of it, but time and time again in this blurb, the idea of memories, nostalgia, imagination, childhood, paradoxical imagery, these fantastical images in your mind comes to the forefront. How does nostalgia and memories that you've accumulated throughout your life and the role they play in your imagination, how do those influence and inspire your artwork?
I think we have a tendency as humans to idealize our memories. The good moments were better than they actually were, or the bad moments were worse than they really were. And those moments are just things that are, but there are things that we hold on to throughout our lives, the good and the bad, and the good and the bad things that we project about or that we feel that we are experiencing in the present. This feeling of nostalgia, we want things to be different all the time, right? There's some level, and this is where it comes, I think, from my own kind of experience, is we not being happy with reality, whatever that is. It used to be more on a personal level. I was very unsatisfied with my own personal experience of life. Mm. And that's not the case anymore, but I'm generally still unhappy with reality as it is. You know, take a little bit of a tangent. I don't know how to say this without being judgy, but I have stepchildren, and sometimes they need to go to school or they need to go pick up something at the grocery store or whatever. And sometimes that takes place during the day. And they're 15. We will get in the car or I'll need to go somewhere and do something. And for example, this. And then when I had to go work, I would get mad at traffic. And now that I don't have to be in traffic all of the time, I get in my car and I think, what are these people doing every single day? They're doing the same thing over and over and over. Mm. And it's creating no benefit whatsoever to their life. Sitting in traffic an hour each way every day is, I mean, maybe a few people are listening to some audiobooks, you know,
yeah,
working on their MBA, reading some literature, whatever it is, right? I'm sure there's tons of people doing that. But it's this menial repetition of wasted time. And I think a lot of people want out of that. So, you know, a lot of them are relishing or dwelling on this nostalgia. And it's something that I don't necessarily do so much anymore, but that's a feeling that I want to kind of evoke. I want to create these experiences of, even if they're manufactured, of kind of a general, almost generic scene that kind of reminds you of something, but you can't put your finger on it. But man, and those are probably the most rewarding interactions with viewers or collectors that I have is, it's not the, this is amazing, this is beautiful, this is this. It's the, my grandmother used to collect elephant toys, the sheaf, right, whatever. And we had this, through my childhood, I would collect these elephant toys and with her, and we had my grandmother and I had this elephant toy collection, and that reminds me of my grandmother. That, and it like doesn't, you know, and that might not even have been the intent in my head when I was making it, right? But it goes back to that's not my decision once it's on the wall. Those are the kind of most rewarding. At that, I don't even care if you buy it, because that was so touching. And that is such the kind of experience that I'm looking for.
So is that more valuable to you than the art critic or art collector who comes in with their, you know, tortoise shell horn rim glasses and their turtleneck and their whatever wool suit and cherry loafers, and they're, you know, talking about the technique and the placement? And
I've never really dealt with art critics, and like collectors and stuff are they're super wonderful, and they're collectors for a reason, because they have those kinds of stories, or they have that relationship to it, or
And I'm being somewhat facetious,
sure,
and exaggerating, right? But yeah,
we tend to try to think of having fond memories of the past, and that's what these are intended to do. So their physical construction is part of that. There's some other subtle tones, like subtle notes, like you had mentioned, like the organic with the constructed parts. That's part of the grid and the process. If you want to get into like the actual process of making, I have no problem talking about the entire process. When someone comes in and they want to talk shop, I'm fine talking shop. You know, what type of glue do you use? Or that kind of thing, technique and stuff. I like that. That's fine. Even if someone's being judgy when they're asking me questions about their what materials and things that I'm using, I don't mind whatsoever.
Is that something that you've learned over time as an artist? The skin has grown thicker, or have you always kind of had that disposition going into your work?
I think the skin's gotten a little thicker, you know. I've also become a little more like, I don't really care what anyone else thinks about, right? My emotional and mental well-being is not hanging on whether someone likes or dislikes something that I've made. You know, I've detached from many things, that being one of them, where they're not going to make or break my day. Now, I will admit, if someone is in love with a piece or whatever and has a story like that elephant one that I used, that's going to make me feel great. But if someone hates something, then it's not really going to bug me too much. Enough people do like it that the people that don't bother me much.
Sure. Sure. Is it getting one kind of last question on my end about the actual technique and method? Is it all photography? Or do you play with other elements of, you know, painting, sketching, drawing, doodling, whatever, right? And whether by hand or on Photoshop, digitally, whatever. Or is it all different photography elements coming together?
So if I'm using toys or when I'm out shooting, I'm trying to shoot them like this would be, it's, so today would not be a good day for shooting because of the hard shadows cast by the sunlight. So a great day would be completely overcast, but bright.
Okay.
So it mutes everything. So I photograph everything as flat as possible with no shadowing, for various reasons, because in the building of these images in Photoshop, I might move the light source around, which means I'm going to have to move the shadows around. So what I do is on a separate layer in Photoshop is I will paint a separate you know, a shadow on a separate layer, and just kind of build those up with you know, paint brushes and textures that I photographed. It could be wood, weird wood floor, or just, you know, whatever, fencing and concrete and just stains and just whatever, and kind of build up these textures. I love texture. There's a whole reason for the textures too, but so yeah, the images are shot as flat as possible, and then their characteristics, their shadowing and layering and stuff is all done like digitally. And in some cases, I don't always use a photograph of a sky or of clouds, of real clouds. Like a lot of my clouds are just pillow stuffing.
Oh, interesting.
And the sky will just be a color gradient.
Sure.
You know, and I'm not going to photograph stars. So, you know, those will just be like paintbrush and digitally done.
Yeah. I think that makes that's really where kind of that surreal juxtaposition comes in, because you're blending so many different elements, right? Whether that's, you know, things that you're touching up by hand or things as other things, right? Like pillow stuffing as clouds, that, because you blend it together so nicely in this image, it's so cohesive that you're not able to discern and pick apart the individual elements by the naked eye, right? At least not when you're just like looking at it on a wall. Maybe if you've had it in front of you for a prolonged period of time, you can kind of start doing that. But I think just from me having seen your work on the wall at galleries, it's all very seamless, right? And I think that's where the mystery comes in and the magic comes in. You talked about somebody seeing something and not really being able to put their finger on it. It's very familiar. Everything in the work is familiar, but it's also taken together. It's all very alien. You are looking at things that you recognize, but you can't really make sense of it. But all the component elements are there and familiar to you, but put together as one piece.
Right.
That's when it becomes fantastical and surreal. And in that way, you are blending, in my opinion, Dali with Magritte, in that there is the world in which these things live is not our world.
That's right.
It's this alien landscape, alien world, but all the different elements are things that we can put our finger on and say, that's familiar to me, and I know that that exists in my world, but this is not my world.
That's right. And that's this duality of kind of our existence, of the what's really going on and our perception of what's going on. So, and our perception tends to be exaggerated and idealized, and reality is pretty much more just kind of, you know, gray, not too far up or down. We have these experiences. We all have very similar life experiences. And there's a caveat to that. I mean, there are some specifics that are along race, gender, ethnicity. There's going to be some pretty unique experiences that individuals are going to have that others are not. However, those people, there are still groups. There's not everybody's an alcoholic, but there are tons of AA meetings. So even if you fall into one of those groups that the larger entirety of humanity experience, there's going to be enough people within your little segment that you're going to be able to reach out to and find some help. I'm not speaking to those kind of micro experiences that small groups of people have. I'm speaking on the general flat tire of life that we've all had, right? The real generic ideas of we've all fallen in love. We've all had heartbreak. We've all had successes. We've all had crushing failures. We've all like overcome something that we're like, yay about. And we've all had some battle that we're trying to fight, and we're all struggling through some sort of daily life grind or whatever it is. We can all relate to those kind of common things. So those are kind of like the experiences that these animals are metaphors for. So like trying to find a freedom, and a lot of that comes from my own holding myself back, not really going after the passion and the creative side, and blaming other people, my parents namely, for keeping me from doing what I wanted to do in my life. So that's where a lot of the freedom flying kind of aspects come through in a lot of my work, but if you look at them, some of them aren't as free as they appear to be. Like if they're in a balloon, the balloon's gonna go where the wind's blowing. And there's a juxtaposition of some of the animals that are utilized in certain images where two animals that may or may not be known to get along well are doing something to help each other or whatever. And it just kind of says that help comes from where we may least expect it. So always remain open-minded and willing. Mm. And you never know where things are going to come. And it takes a village, even though you're doing like this solo solitary kind of work, it takes a village. And don't be afraid of the village and let the village help you. And so these are all like kind of experiences that I think we tend to have and share as humans, you know?
You're highlighting something that I keep thinking about it the more you're explaining it, is that life is pretty fantastical, you know, and nuanced and colorful, but we have been cultured as a society, and there's variations of that across different, you know, actual, you know, countries and cultures and upbringings, but generally speaking, we've been conditioned to not really take in a lot of that nuance and the novelty and the beauty and the abstraction of life, because that makes it more complicated inherently. And we are cultured to live as streamlined and efficiently as possible, right? So we don't see a lot of that color. You mentioned that artists think differently, and I think it really is when you step out of that parameter, that paradigm of how we are expected to function within a society, that you begin to question the absurdity of all of it and saying that, like, how is everyone so satisfied just repeating the same experience day in and day out, even if that experience is miserable and a waste of time? But
and they may not even know that they're miserable.
That's the thing. Yeah. It really, you really do have to be able to force yourself out of that perspective. And your work does that in a way that is, you know, palpable. You don't need to quit your job and become an artist to feel what you feel through your work, you know? And I think that's why your work is as successful and as, you know, emotive and as beautiful as it is. On your website, I noticed that you are also working with horses. You have a whole series on animals. You have a whole series on trees. Mm-hmm. And these are less of these kind of surreal worlds that you've built, and more focusing on the actual subject of horse, various animals, trees. Is that something that is purely a side project, or is that work that you are transitioning more and more into full time?
So those animals, that whole series is very old. And that series was utilized. This is like that whole be open to kind of suggestion kind of thing. I did one thing and Yukai said, you know, someone would be interested if this was on a big panel. Because I was kind of like only doing like prints and small things. And he said, could you make a big panel, like a big piece of it? I said, I can try.
Yeah.
And this is that, like, process. The zebra in that animal series is the one that got sanded down, built, sanded down, oh, built, really? Sanded down, built, because I was really bad at it. So that was those animals were the, because he had someone that was interested in an image but wanted it really large, and I didn't know how to do it, and that was the genesis of the process, mm-hmm. of how to make it large, how to make the process actually have some sort of meaning, as opposed to just building it and slapping a photo on some wood. How does the process, you know, add to a narrative? And so that's where those animals are old, and they've done pretty well for me in terms of, you know, financially, like licensing and things. And I made like all of those panels, and gosh, I think they're all gone. I gave some away. So the trees were just kind of, like, just really kind of like a study in isolation, because they're kind of isolated.
Right. Well, it's just generally one tree per picture.
Right.
Yeah.
Where I grew up in Ohio, it was just flat. Mm-hmm. You know, if I needed flat horizon, landscapes or whatever. I could do that all day up there. Up here, it's forget it. So yeah, I was really interested in just kind of like this isolated kind of tree, this thing. And
they're beautiful, whether or not they're old work or new work. I think that they speak a lot about your work. And I know we're running a bit longer on time here, so I wanted to kind of sort of wrap it up, not really actually wrap it up, because I do have one or two more questions, but
sure.
I did want to come back to the U Gallery global representation that you mentioned, because you mentioned you wanted to come back to that and talk about that. So you're represented by Kylan Art here in Atlanta, and U Gallery globally. So what does that mean? And
okay, U Gallery is there's several of these services. Now there's a whole lot of things that people can utilize. When I've given talks or someone finds out that I'm an artist, whatever, like how do you make it, whatever, and there's a lot of questions about the financial side of it, and typically from artists or people interested in doing it, and you need as many income streams as possible, so if one goes away you're not really hurt or whatever. And this is just, you know, something for other artists. U Gallery, and I think Saatchi Gallery is like this, is a lot like a regular gallery. So if you have paintings in your inventory, or if you have work in your inventory, you have to submit to them just like any other gallery. It's the same commission rate. They take care of all the shipping. So you follow their instructions and you take photographs and stuff, and then they list it once it gets approved, if it gets approved, after you've gone through their application and they represent you or whatever. And then you take the photos and all of that stuff, and the piece gets up there. If it sells, you get your 50%. They ship you a box that's specifically sized for the piece of art that you took pictures of and told them the sizes of. You pull out the foam, you throw it in there, you slap the sticker on, you print out the shipping label, you put it over there, you take it to FedEx, and you're done. Like, you don't pay for shipping, right? And so if you have pieces in your inventory that are just sitting there rotting, get them listed, start making some money, you know, potentially.
Right.
It's just one more avenue.
Yeah.
And it's all original stuff too. So they don't deal with like reproductions or whatever, unless you want them to handle like doing reproductions of prints.
Sure.
Then they will do that. And then you don't do anything. You just get money if it sells. So yeah. And that's a good way to just, you know, have something else on your CV to generate some sales, to have an income stream, a revenue stream. And they've done well for me.
You nice. Know? Great advice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very tactical, good advice for anyone who's trying to make it as an artist.
Yeah. It's just an opportunity. And it's like a free opportunity. You really don't have to do a whole lot of work.
Really? Okay.
And if you just have stuff sitting at home, you're like, oh my God, what am I going to do with this stuff? Let it try to make money for you.
Of course. Yeah. Unless you're one of those fuck the world, fuck the system kind of people, and then just let it sit, I guess. That's cool too. But, all right. So just kind of as we get towards the end here, what's next? What's next for you as an artist? What's any big shows or collections or anything coming out that you want to talk about? Or is there a different style of work that you're working on that you want to talk about, or whatever? Floor is yours.
A few shows ago at Kylan Art, I had a show with an artist named Larry Anderson and Andrew Cantonese. Mm-hmm. And Larry titled the show, I think Todd Anderson was a part of that show too. He titled the show Magic.
Okay, I remember that show.
I want to properly, who was in that show? It was Larry Anderson, Andrew Cantonese, and who was the third one or fourth one?
So for Magic, Larry Anderson, yourself, Kevin Palme? Palme?
Yeah, Palm. Kevin Palm.
Palm.
Yes.
Kevin Palm. And Andrew Cantonese.
Yeah, so, right. So Andrew Cantonese and Palm. He does the ice cubes.
That's right, yeah. Gorgeous, by the way, and yeah. Massive.
Yeah, right. yeah, they're very awesome. Larry titled the show Magic. I said, you know, and I knew the title well, and it was like 6 months before the show or something. So I kind of changed my direction and went specifically with, I'm going to try to do magic, literal. I'm going to take that literally. And what does everything that I've done so far, what does that look like if it's just magical? Mm. So I kind of just internalize that word and try to just build magic. And so I'm going to keep working on that, like, one word magic thing instead of these like larger narratives, and kind of keep it a little more narrowly focused, but still have that same kind of feeling, but more magical.
And I believe the photo they used here is Tappy and the Moon.
Yes.
Tappy and the Moon?
Tappy and the Moon. Yeah.
It's an owl on a tree swing.
That owl's name is Tappy. And
that's
it's
a
from,
real owl?
Yeah. And it's from the Atlanta Wild Animal Rescue Effort, AWARE.
Okay.
And it's one of those things where I contacted them and said, hey, here's who I am. Here's what I do. Can I come take some photos with some of your animals? And they said, well, we have some ambassador animals, and they really went out of their way and gave me some access that awesome. They didn't have to. So what I did is, at that point, I was making some of my more popular pieces into editions of 5 and really small panels to hit that, like, kind of a specific price point.
Sure, yeah.
And so I gave them like 4 panels for their fundraiser auction that they do every year.
Okay.
Just, you know, not that that's super wonderful or anything, but it's like the least that I could do, because they really went out of their way to, you know, make sure that someone was there. They brought out the animals that I wanted. I'm like, hey, can I see a barn owl? And they're like, you know, they bring it out, and they, you know, great horned owl. And that owl's name is Tappy, and he's one of their ambassador owls.
That's very cool. It's a gorgeous piece. Anyone is interested, go look up Greg's work, gregnoblinart.com, and look up Tappy and the Moon. Gorgeous piece. And then I'm sure you'll find many, many more that strike your fancy. My favorite, my personal favorite, is Mr. Penguin Goes on Holiday.
Oh.
It reminds me almost like a Don Quixote, lost in the desert, penguin standing by a cactus with his pack mule full of this old kind of Victorian-looking luggage.
If you go... I have a time lapse of me making that digitally on YouTube.
Oh, do you really?
Yeah. And yeah, you can see what the kind of the process is of like all of these boxes on here. Right. Some of those are actually made, right? But so I had to build them in Photoshop. And some of them, like, that's actual box in our house. That might actually be a box in our house.
That's wild.
But some of the boxes that I had, like, just they weren't going to work, right?
Right. Right.
So I had to invent some, and
that's awesome.
So that's what I did. Yeah, I use the same rope for everything. I have a picture of a rope, that's like a awesome. Segment of rope about this long, and that I photographed just on white, and
sure.
And it's the same. I use that rope for everything.
It's fantastic, man. I mean, what you really, no matter how what level of depth you look at it, you get in and you see just a lot of complexity that you really put a lot of time into these pieces with how different elements are positioned, how they play with light and shadow. It's just a lot of nuance and detail. But yeah, Mr. Penguin Goes on Holiday is my favorite. I'll watch the YouTube video for sure. We might even put it up on the website or a link to it.
It's a little long, but you could.
Yeah,
sure.
We'll put it up on it. We'll put a link to it up if people want to check that out. Greg, to kind of close it out, where can people find you now? Where can they find your work now? And where can they learn more about you online, on social media, digitally?
Sure. It's going to be my website, gregnoblin.com or gregnoblinart.com. And on Instagram, probably. I don't really do Twitter. So it's just going to be Instagram.com, Greg Noblin. It's going to be my username. And that's really it. YouTube is just, I was talking about revenue stuff. So there's just a bunch of junk on YouTube that I have on YouTube, just kind of like monetize some stuff. I do some like bad music on the side. So it's But it's just fun. It's like just a, you know, it's a hobby. It's a creative outlet. And so YouTube's not super that important. But yeah, my website and Instagram are going to be that. And you can, if anyone ever has any questions or whatever, they feel free to email me. It's gregnoblin@me.com. You can email me any question and I'll, you know.
Where can somebody buy a piece if they want to?
Call you, Kai.
All right.
KylanArt.com.
Greg Noblin. Amazing having you on the show. Love the conversation.
Well, thank you.
I'm really enjoying diving into your work deeper and the man behind it, and hope to keep up the relationship and,
sure,
and
yeah,
see
absolutely.
You know, all the great things that are yet to come. So Greg Noblin, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Show ATL Podcast, the podcast where we seek to find and highlight Atlanta creatives and creators and tell the stories of the people and organizations making amazing things in our city. I am your host, Parsa Benamory. Our show today was produced by Mr. Coleman Erkins with help from myself and Corrigan Nolan. Our music is produced by Relax with Alex. Want to thank all of the guests who come onto this program and tell their amazing stories with us and share with us, as well as to our wonderful listeners who continue to support us week in and week out. If you love this episode, if you love this show as a whole, if you like Show ATL and consider it something that you listen to frequently, please consider giving us a 5-star rating or a nice review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever else you use to listen to your podcasts. Please consider supporting us if you care to. Again, we're a small team working to put together this show for you every week. And we have a Patreon page, www.patreon.com/showATL. You can give a one-time donation or a recurring donation. All funds will be used to make this show better and better and better for you. So we would greatly appreciate that. Thank you again for listening. Thank you again for supporting us. Thank you again for being a part of the conversation that we continue to have day in and day out to make our city a better place, a more creative place. We will catch you next time. Thank you. Goodbye. Today's episode is brought to you by Old Fourth Ward Light Co. Based out of Atlanta, Old Fourth Ward Light Co. leverages unique design and artistry blended with unusual everyday items to create really unique and cool looking lamps. If you go to www.oldfourthwardlight.com and click on the shop button, you'll be able to see their full range of products. And if you enter the coupon code SHOWATL at checkout, you can get 10% off any order. Thanks.